behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
Good day. I'm Ben Dolan.
Oh, that doesn't pass muster, Ben.
It doesn't.
No,
it doesn't.
No. It's got to have more flair to it. More, g'day, mate.
G'day.
Yeah, that's maybe the better way to do it. And you know what? I know Australians are laughing at me right now because I did that. But there's a point to be made here, Ben, and that is that this request comes mainly from an Australian listener, which, by the way, we've got a lot of Australian listeners.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes mainly from an Australian listener, but there were some follow-ups, I guess, because we've got three people that we've heard of that are interested in this that I want to point out here. Wayne Robertson from Melbourne.
Mm. Hey, nice.
Ah, yes. Yeah, I was following Scott Gibbs, who is another Australian who wrote in and gave us kind of a pronunciation guide.
Yeah.
He said, I think it's Melbourne. No, that's close enough.
Wayne wasn't the only one who wrote in, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We've also got some emails from two Americans.
Yeah.
We've got
Joshua Baker.
Uh-huh. Out there in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And from Connecticut as well, right?
Yeah. John Rinks or Rinkies from Connecticut. That's right, Ben. And, you know, so a lot of people are interested in this, and I'm not even convinced that that's the only ones. I'm just convinced that those are the emails that haven't yet been deleted from my system because, you know, there's like a 90-day thing, the weird deletion thing. I think other people have talked to us about doing a utility vehicle podcast in the past.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't mean to shortchange them on credit for this, but, you know, the Australian listeners, they're really into this because, Ben, this is an Australian thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a way of life.
This is an Aussie vehicle. There are no ifs, ands, or buts. Other countries may have these vehicles, as we'll come to find, but when it comes to the culture and the lifestyle, make no mistakes. This is Australian, ladies and gentlemen, the coupe utility vehicle, better known as the ute.
Yeah, that's right. And the strange thing about these are, you know, they've got a bed like a cargo truck would, or like a pickup truck would.
Yep.
They've got a passenger compartment like a coupe would.
Mm-hmm.
They've got, but also a truck has a coupe or a cab, I think is what they call it in a truck, really,
cab.
And a bed. And it's usually a bigger thing. It's usually a heavy duty type thing.
Uh-huh.
The strange thing about these is they look more like a car, but they have the attributes of a truck in the back end, of course. And, you know, the similar, you know, two seats typically.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call these things? Where do you classify them? How do you classify them? And I guess the answer is, I mean, you just said it. It's a coupe utility. And that goes back, Ben. It goes way back to the 1930s, the early 1930s.
Uh-huh.
And it's credited to an Australian woman who wrote a letter to a Ford designer. And
yes.
this letter, I guess, and this is supposedly a famous letter, I guess, you know, that she wrote in and said that she's a farmer's wife and in Victoria, Australia, and said that they have a farm, you know, they have a pickup truck, apparently.
Uh-huh.
And said that they need a vehicle that they can also go to church on Sunday and they can take the pigs to the market on Monday.
Why don't you build people like us a vehicle to go to church in on a Sunday and which can carry our pigs to market on Mondays, said this letter in 1932.
Mm-hmm.
It was received in the Ford Australia plant in, I'm going to mispronounce this, Geelong, Victoria.
Close enough, Ben.
Well, we'll see.
And and so this was sent to a Ford designer. His name was Lou Brandt. And Lou Brandt took this to heart and said, you know what, why aren't we doing something like this? Because there have been pickup trucks around since about, and I'm going to ballpark this, Ben, 1925, okay. When Ford, based on the Model T, created the pickup truck. And then there's, I think there's some, again, controversy over that date and, you know, who had the first one or whatever.
Well, let's qualify it as mass-produced.
Sure. First mass-produced pickup truck, Ford, based on the Model T, 1925. So, you know, we're only 7 years past that.
Mm.
But the pickup truck wasn't cutting it for this woman to go to church, apparently. She didn't want to show up to church in a dirty, you know, work truck from the farm.
Right.
So she needed something that had the characteristics of a coupe, but could also work as a truck in the same vehicle.
And Bant was only 22 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a young designer. And it took him about 2 years, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Before this design finally got to production, which isn't really all that long when you think about what had to happen.
Right.
So you know, again, this is Ford Australia that this is coming through. And by 1934, they're credited with creating the first coupe utility in 1934, released for the Australian market only. So that's where it was. It was based there. That was just for them. That's their own vehicle. Mm. Had nothing to do with the rest of the world. This is their own thing.
None whatsoever. 112-inch wheelbase, the rear, the pickup bed's probably about 5 feet, 5 inches long. Payload of 1,200 pounds, not too bad. And they were also the first vehicles to offer an all-weather cabin.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they did very well in the sales because people love this new type of car or truck or whatever it is, a coupe utility. And GM's Holden division, which is a subsidiary that we're going to talk about a little bit later in the podcast, they, in 1935, so just 1 year later, Ben, they come out with kind of a response to this vehicle, you know, something that they could also sell there in the Australian market. And they held on to that in the Australian market for a long, long time. In fact, both companies, Ford and Holden, are still producing Ute vehicles in Australia.
Yes, and they are not the only ones in the game. Now, one thing that might seem strange to some people hearing this is that when the very first coupe utility came out in Australia, that cab was considered kind of a luxury in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, because the pickup trucks, I guess, they had a more of a, I don't know, I want to say rustic or more of a rough and tumble, more of a, I don't know, that's not the way to put it.
Oh, utilitarian.
Utilitarian, that's maybe the better way to put it, that it's a little sparse, a little Spartan. How about
that?
Yeah,
there we go, nice.
Yeah, it wasn't, it didn't have the accoutrements that a cab would have. It didn't have in all the comforts you would expect. And you had to step way up into them. That might have been a problem as well for the woman who wrote the letter that, you know, she's in her Sunday dress or whatever, and you have to, you know, jump up into a cab that's 2 feet off the ground. Or
insulation is lacking.
Exactly.
So if it's especially cold, if it's especially hot, no one wants to show up to church sweaty.
Exactly. So, you know, there were a lot of good reasons behind the creation of this vehicle. And it was very smart of her to write that and say that, you know, I'm looking for something that's a combination of the two. And Ford was happy to build a new car, I'm sure, that, you know, ended up being wildly popular. I'm sure they were very happy afterwards, as was Holden, you know, GM.
Sure.
They said, you know, this is fantastic. We've got this, you know, burgeoning Australian market that we want to sell to, and this is the perfect vehicle for that.
Do you want to talk about the Holden coupe?
Sure.
Okay, so Holden came out with their Chevy coupe utility in 1935, which, to me, when we were looking into this, it's startling just how far back Ute culture goes, because a lot of times when people think of utility vehicles outside Australia, I'll say, they tend to think of sports utility vehicles, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. We think of them as they're entirely enclosed.
Right.
I mean, we don't even think of them as having a bed like this. You know, if you do go back in the United States history, though, we do have some examples of utility vehicles, or rather coupe utility vehicles,
yes,
here in the United States, as well as other markets, because this caught on. I mean, it took a while for it to develop here, and I don't know why, Ben. I don't know why the break in communication, or I don't know what happened exactly, because it's Ford Australia producing these things. And then we find out that Ford United States produces the first coupe utility in the United States, but it's like, 30 years later? No, 20 years later, 25 years later, something like that. 25, maybe.
Yeah.
1957 is when Ford came out with the Ranchero here in the United States, and that lasted all the way until 1979, so it was a popular vehicle.
It was a good run, yeah.
It really was. It was a long run, but they didn't come out with it until 1957 as opposed to 1934 in Australia. That's strange to me that they wouldn't translate that over to U.S. sales.
Yeah, and one thing that is also interesting here is when Wayne wrote to us, he had a nice part of his email that I think did sum up part of the situation for the Utes in general. It said, due to the isolation of Australia, car companies were forced to design and build cars here, as importing cars to Australia was virtually impossible. Or I think maybe the only thing that I would say, Wayne, is I'll agree with virtually impossible, but probably more it's a matter of extremely expensive. You know, it will cost so much to ship a bunch of cars to Australia that the markup that an average citizen would have to pay would be just beyond affordable.
Or the profit margins would be so small that the company wouldn't even want to do that. They would just say, we're just not going to even bother with that.
Right. So they had to have a domestic car industry. And I guess maybe the companies outside of Australia, including GM, were waiting around to see how well this did.
Possibly, but 25 years or, I mean, I got to do the math on the numbers here anyways, but, You know, I've got to believe, though, that Ford Australia is talking to Ford US. I know that they
are. Surely.
Of course they are. There's no doubt about it that they're talking to each other. They know what vehicles are produced in each, you know, in each region. And I know that they're saying, like, we've got this wildly popular utility vehicle out here. You may want to give it a go in the United States and see what happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, for whatever reason, Ford must have decided that it just wasn't the right time. It wasn't the right place for them. They had other designs in mind. You know, they had other things that were more important, bigger fish to fry.
right.
So, and it wasn't long after Ford Ranchero came around that, and El Camino came out, you know, with Chevrolet, because they had to,
yes.
they had to respond to Ford in some way. So there's about a 2-year gap, like we talked about in the other podcast, in the Monte Carlo podcast.
Uh-huh.
There's that 2-year gap when they were trying to develop a new vehicle, a new product. So in 1959, they came out with the Chevy El Camino. And then, you know, it wasn't long after that that, you know, like Subaru came along and, you know, some of these other manufacturers that decided, well, this is a good idea. We're going to get into, you know, these compact utility vehicles or these coupe utility vehicles because, a lot of people really, really enjoy them. They're very functional. They're very, I don't know. They suit a lot of people for a lot of different needs.
Yes, and I have to point this out. Could I tell a story briefly, Scott?
Of course.
All right. The El Camino. I have personal experience in El Camino.
That's right, you do.
You and I have talked a little bit about this off the air. So I guess this would be back in probably the early 90s or so. My dad buys an El Camino from his boss.
That's a bad move.
We find out about it when he comes home, and this just monstrosity, man. It's probably third, fourth generation, mid, late 70s, right?
So it's a big one.
It's huge. It's a beast. You can smell the burning oil down the street.
Mm-hmm.
He's hobbling home. My mom doesn't know what the French is going on since we are a family show. And at first, Old Man Bolin is in some hot water when he explains, yes, I bought this. We have this now. And, you know, my mother's saying, what? How much did you pay for this thing? This is ridiculous. She thought it was a rolling pile of crap because
sure.
the car had been through a lot. It wasn't in the best condition. And he said, well, we argued about the price a lot. And then I insisted, you know, my boss wanted to give it to me just to get it out of his yard, and I insisted that I pay at least $80.
What a deal.
Yeah, what a deal.
What a deal. That's cool. And you got to drive this car, right?
Yeah, I got to drive it.
Very good.
Now, I'm going to be honest with you guys. I don't know if there's a statute of limitations for this. I was underage. I was under adult supervision.
That's okay.
This car was, I loved it, man. It was a monster because it has actually some pretty sizable performance. Even in this dilapidated condition, we had it for years. It had a hole in the passenger side floorboard with a plank of wood. And so one of my favorite things to do was to lift up the plank of wood. And, thank God I was never dumb enough to actually try this, but I'd lift up the plank of wood and try to run like a Flintstones car.
Oh no, that's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm pretty good at terrible ideas, but even I threw that one out the window.
That would pull you right under.
So one thing that we know about these is that, they're pretty powerful engines, but the Ranchero and the El Camino, in the U.S. were sort of, I guess, confusing to, the pickup truck culture
yes.
in the United States.
Yes, because in the United States, the pickup truck, I guess the versions of the pickup truck that we are accustomed to, have grown into more heavy-duty, purpose-built vehicles, and that they would have, you know, specific beds for different jobs even.
Yeah.
And they would have, you know, something that's clearly separated. I mean, that you can see that there's even a gap between the cab and the bed. It's not like a coupe design where it's all one flowing design.
Right.
You know, you can picture what I mean. There's no gap between the bed and the passenger compartment. And, you know, it wasn't anything like what the Australians were seeing in their vehicles, where there were some, I guess I'll call them luxury appointments if you can at that time. You know, they were more advanced, I guess, than what, the utilitarian pickup trucks would be here in the United States.
Absolutely.
And we had definitely gone the opposite way in that they were used more as heavy duty work vehicles and strictly for that. And then we had other vehicles for different purposes, whereas they were trying to meld the two together and did so very successfully.
Yeah, and continues to do so today. As a matter of fact, the Well, I don't want to go straight to the future.
How about this? Let's not go to the future because I want to hold off on that for a bit. I know we're going to talk about Holden. We're going to talk about Ford, Australia. We're going to talk about some of the modern versions of these things that we definitely want to get to. I also want to go into a little bit more Ranchero history, a little bit more El Camino history,
mm-hmm. okay.
and talk about some of the big engines and some of the small engines and some of the vehicles that they were derived from. But I think we should kind of stay maybe in the early days of the Ute right now and stick with Australia if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah.
And, I think that, we need to mention this too, that there was a convertible version of the utility vehicle that popped up in the early 1930s, or the mid 1930s rather, and it was called the Roadster Utility. And this is, you would think it'd be something completely outlandish, but you gotta remember there were Ford pickup trucks that were also Roadsters that had a similar look to them at the time. So, man, I mean, it's really making sense in the way these two things are working together, and then eventually they start to drift apart, like I just mentioned, with the U.S. taking more of a heavy duty stance on trucks, pickup trucks, and then them taking the angle more towards utility vehicles or coupe utility vehicles, which are more of a passenger car with a bed also.
Yes, and let's go into
how about the 1950s?
Okay,
all right, so 1951. Holden replaced, they released a model based on its 48215 model, which was a sedan, and it sort of made like the Australia at that point, by 1951 they were the leading builder of coupe utility vehicles at the time. Now Holden, they had surpassed Ford, which initially started this whole thing
with the Ford Falcon.
Exactly. So in 1951, Holden is really surpassing Ford even at their own game, I guess. And it's kind of a tradition, that Holden has kind of hung on to for a long, long time of building these two-door passenger car, sedan chassis-based utility vehicles, that have this tray at the back. And Holden's really, really good at this. And we'll talk about Holden's specialty vehicles soon enough.
Yes, all great points. And, Scott, I owe you an apology because I think I jumped a little bit around into modern era stuff.
No, not a problem, because that plays a big role in this podcast.
Oh, which we're going to go into. But first, it's time for a word from one of our sponsors. Yes, it's speaking of not wanting to be left behind. That leads us directly to Ford's constant catch-up game with Holden, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, the opposite way around.
Oh, wait, the opposite. Yeah, well, you're right.
Ford started it.
Holden dominated it.
That's right.
And then Ford tried to come back.
They did.
And
they did so in the United States market as well. They decided, let's translate this over to U.S. sales, like we mentioned. Because I said, there's that time lag in between when they developed this in Australia and then when they released it in the United States. And, it's very popular in Australia, but they came out with the Ranchero in the United States in 1957, and that lasted until 1979. So, again, it's a good long run. It's a coupe utility vehicle, front engine, rear-wheel drive. And there were three classes of vehicle, Ben, that were built between, in that era.
Right.
So if you look at the full-size vehicles from 1957 to 1959, those were based on the Ford Fairlane. If you go to the next set of vehicles, which, and these don't follow the generations, by the way, there were seven generations of Ford Ranchero, but only three different size classes. The next size class is compact, and that was from 1960 to 1965, and that was based on the Ford Falcon.
Yeah.
And this is the kind, I see a lot of these Ford Falcon Rancheros around. I think that they must have produced the most of those, of that type.
I think so.
If I had to guess, because that's the kind that I typically see, parked in, someone's yard with weeds growing through it or whatever. You don't see a lot of them on the road by any means.
I saw one on the road one time.
Really? One time. Yeah, one time. Yeah, that's a good point, man. I did see one. As a matter of fact, 2 days ago, a Ford Falcon-based one at a body shop that was in all primer, still had some rust on the body, some rust holes. The interior was gone, and it had looked like just shop wheels on it. Like the rims that are just generic rims that are painted bright red so they don't leave the shop on the car.
Mm-hmm.
That type of vehicle. But other than that, I haven't seen any on the road for a long time.
That sounds like a mechanic's pet.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it was. Maybe it's a shop project. The last one was the midsize vehicle, or Ranchero rather. It was from 1966 to 1979, and they call that midsize. To me, Ben, that was a pretty big vehicle because it was based on the Torino and the Ford LTD, and even, Ben, to some extent, in 1977, the Ford Thunderbird, which I found kind of strange, but I guess if you look at it, you can really see, the Torino coming out through it. You can see the Thunderbird characteristics in it.
Yeah.
A lot of manufacturers do that. They take characteristics of one popular model and they put them on another just so that, it becomes a more marketable venture, I guess, for them.
It's I file that under don't fix it if it ain't broke.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing was based on a two-door station wagon design. It was adapted from that. And of course, it had the cab and cargo area, just like you would expect. And it sold so well that, GM eventually had to, I guess compensate by coming up with their own version of that, which was the El Camino I'll talk about in just a minute.
Uh-huh.
But for the Ford Ranchero, they had a bunch of different engines for this through the seven generations, as you can imagine. And I'll just mention that, you know, the smallest and the largest. How about that? And maybe
that sounds perfect.
How about this? One other interesting version too, I think we'll throw in there. But the smallest was 170 cubic inch engine, which is only 2.8 liters, Ben. And they called that the Thrift Power I6. So an inline six engine.
Yeah.
And it was basically the Falcon 6 engine. If you've ever heard of the Falcon 6, that's what this engine was. Makes sense, I guess, you know, that it would go in the compact version of the Torino. I'm sorry, the Ranchero, rather.
The Thrift version.
Thrift Power inline six.
Right.
I don't know if I'd really want that version. Anyways, the largest engine, Ben, it went all the way up to 460 cubic inches, which is a 7.5 liter V8, and that was the sixth generation between 72 and 76. And I guess I got to mention this last one because there was a Ranchero GT version, and we just talked about GT cars not too long ago, but
yep.
Ranchero GT, and it was based on the Ford Torino GT trim package, I guess. It had the same type of trim package as you would find on the Torino. And it had the 428 Cobra Jet V8. And then I think later they came out with a version that had the 429 Cobra Jet V8. Or rather just the 429 V8. I don't know if it's a Cobra Jet or not.
Okay.
But still, you know, fantastic versions of those things. And we mentioned that, you know, Chevy came out with something as a reaction car. And this is your favorite, right?
Yeah.
Well, not your favorite, but the one you have, you know.
Yeah.
The one history with.
That I have history with, the El Camino. Mm-hmm. But, the El Camino has a precedent, because in around 1955, Chevy introduced the Cameo Carrier, mm-hmm. which is a pickup truck. But you'll hear people say that this is sort of a harbinger of the Camino. And the reason they'll say that is because it had some things that were, even though it was a light duty pickup truck, it had some things that were typically associated with cars at the time. So passenger car styling, rear fenders, a luxurious interior, optional V8 and auto transmission and so on. Mm-hmm. I think the automatic transmission was one of the big ones. It's
sure.
more associated with a car at that
yeah,
time.
Understood. So throwing in some, what we'll call luxury features.
Yeah, absolutely. And then of course, so Chevy kind of is testing waters with this, and they see that there's enough of a market due to Ford's Ranchero that in 1959, they create the El Camino. And the original El Camino and the original Ranchero only directly compete in 1959. But, that's because they started aiming for different things. So people will tell you that the Ranchero is a little bit more conservative in mm-hmm. comparison to the El Camino, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know, Ben, because it only had an initial run, a production run from 1959 to 1960. And you said that that's the only years that they competed. Now, when they went to a different market, I guess, is what you're saying. They went to, they competed in different, arenas, I suppose.
Yeah. That's
because
correct.
I think, and tell me if I'm reading this wrong.
Okay.
It seems like the Ranchero didn't compete in the performance arena very much. I mean, as far as the way the El Camino did, because El Camino, when you start to talk about the different generations and the performance, the performance of the El Camino, they started to go more towards the performance end of things and, you know, the luxury features and all that, you know, ooh. That, you didn't find necessarily in, or wait, am I back in that? Am I making a mistake on that?
Well,
you said Ford had a few luxury features as well.
Well, I guess what we're saying, I think you're on the right point here with the performance
okay.
of an El Camino. Because, Hot Rod Magazine famously in, they conducted a test of an El Camino that had the powertrain combination available in 1959. So that's a 315 BHP triple carb, 348 V8, with a 4-speed, right?
Okay.
So they got 0 to 60 in around 7 seconds. Estimated top speed, 130 miles per hour. So this thing is not joking.
That is a, you know what, I would just say that's a performance car.
That's performance car territory.
For that era, for 1959, that is definitely a performance vehicle. Now again, that would have had a limited run in 1959 to 1960, and then it went away for about 4 years.
Yes.
It came back in 1964 to 1980, and then it lasted until 1987. But the thing is, the 1964 all the way through 1977 version was based on the Chevelle platform. And that tells you right there, basing it on the Chevelle, this is a performance car. It's a sports car.
Hmm.
You know, with sheep's clothing, I guess, maybe. Is that the way to put it?
That's a great way to put it.
It didn't look like anything really all that spectacular. I mean, it was a neat looking car, and there were some versions of it that, you know, had some really cool looking trim packages, you know.
Sure.
And there was a Chevelle SS, you know, I'm sorry, not a Chevelle, an El Camino SS version that we'll talk about, based on the Chevelle, they also had some of the Chevelle engines, of course.
Right.
And, you know, the Super Sport engine, the 396, which was a series engine that was also available on the Chevelle, 325 to 375 horsepower, something like that. And I think it went up even from there, but we're talking about like the second gen and fifth gen vehicles, because there were five generations of El Camino total.
Uh-huh.
And then later in 1978 to 1987, they switched it over to a vehicle that was based on the G body platform. And the G body platform is like the Buick Regal, the Chevy Malibu, the Monte Carlo, the Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme, the Calais, some of the Pontiacs like the Bonneville and the Grand Prix,
right,
a lot of other vehicles. So the G-body platform was a popular choice in General Motors at that time, and that's why they did that. But from 64 to 77, Ben, based on that Chevelle platform, these things were real, I mean, just out-and-out performance vehicles, really.
Right.
I mean, they had that truck bed, and I understand that probably hurt them a bit. But you could get, you know, the economy version if you got the smallest engine, which was a 194 cubic inch 3.2 liter inline six, you know, kind of small, but they went all the way up to a 454 V8 engine, which is, you know, that's 7.4 liters. That's
exactly
a strong engine.
Yeah.
And everybody knows, I think, the 454, but I think the SS 396, I think that was the strongest one. And something really weird happened, Ben, you know, right around that time. If people recall, that was when the EPA, was it the EPA who did this? They adjusted the gross to net horsepower ratings of all cars, released in 1972.
Right. So, didn't this lead to, being detuned a bit for fuel economy as well?
I don't know about detuning, and they may have done that, but the thing is that, you know, when they did the switch over from gross horsepower to net horsepower, what happened was that the gross horsepower was just the engine on a stand.
Right.
And it was measuring just raw horsepower coming right out of the engine, right at the crank, right?
And the net horsepower is the horsepower that makes it to the road, and moves the weight of the vehicle as well.
That's a good way to put it, Ben. It's with all accessories and emissions controls hooked up to the vehicle.
Yeah.
And my own personal car, my Newport, my Chrysler Newport, suffers from this because,
oh no,
I have an engine, a 440 engine, that's the TNT version, supposedly the high horsepower engine, the
right?
HP version.
Yeah.
But it's from a 1972 car, and it's in a 1967 body. So in 1972, the engine itself is rated far lower than it was in even 1971, even though it's the exact same engine. And it's rated lower than it was in 1969 and 1968. So it's a real frustrating thing for people that have an engine from 1972 that's the same engine.
Ouch.
And there's no difference. It's just it gets the book rating as being far lower. So, for instance, in 1970, if you got a 454 El Camino, you know, with 454 cubic inch engine, it was rated at 450 horsepower, Ben. 450. Oh. That's a huge amount of horsepower for a car. I mean, even a big heavy car like that. And that was the LS6 V8. The same LS6 V8 in 1972, the same 454, rated at 270 horsepower on the new net ratings. So you can see the dramatic decrease in power rating, even though it's the same engine. And you know, it doesn't matter the difference in what they say in the books. It's what you feel, really, I guess, right?
Well, sure, yeah. A rose by any other name for all the English lit majors out there.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. But, you know, the thing is, like, you understand that, you know, like, it's frustrating what happens to these engines and the power drop off at that point and why it happened at that point. So
yeah, and it stinks too for a car collector.
Yeah,
to say like I have a vehicle that on the road when the rubber hits the pavement can do exactly what any other vehicle from a year previous would do.
Exactly. And then in 1973, which is 1 year post these new net ratings, that's when Chevy came out with the El Camino SS, which is the trim option that was available at that time.
Right.
Fourth generation, it had a 350 engine, a 350 engine or a 454 big block. And I think, man, I don't know the horsepower ratings on these things, but I know that it was that dropped off horsepower rating. So you might look at an El Camino SS from that range and say, yeah. I don't know about the performance of this thing. But the truth is, it's a big, powerful, big block engine.
And unfortunately for fans of Ranchero, this great competition ended up with a winner. And I think we can go ahead and call that winner the El Camino just based on production.
I think so. I mean, El Camino in here in the United States, we need to clarify that.
Good clarify.
In the United States, because we're going to move back to Australia for our Australia listeners in just a moment. But, you know, El Camino stuck around until 1987, and I think Ranchero was done by 1979. So there's an 8-year difference there. I guess Chevy decided to hold on to that model just a little bit longer and see if they could, you know, pull a rabbit out of the hat and see if they could keep the sales up.
Yeah.
And I think they just kind of slowly declined and decided that maybe it's something we're not going to continue to invest in. Now, let's move back to Australia.
Yes, let's travel back.
Because there's still a lot of coupe utility production going on there. And I'll tell you that it's a neck and neck battle for a long, long time between Ford Australia and GM's Holden division, which is just like a subsidiary of General Motors, which is run on the Australian continent, over in Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania, yeah, that area.
But those cars are all referred to as Holdens, not as GM.
Yeah. Yeah. So. You wouldn't say that. You would say it's a Holden Ute. And I think that's the Holden Ute is the kind of generic term, I guess, for the whole line of utility vehicles that Holden produces, because there's several. I mean, they do the standard Holden Ute. They do the SV6. They have the whole SS range of vehicles. So if you say Holden Ute, that kind of covers them all, right?
It's like an umbrella term. There is one Ute on our way from the States to Australia. There is one Ute that we should talk about.
What's that one, Ben?
It's the Ute that never was, Scott.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Sure.
Do you want to wait till the end?
Oh, tell you what. Let's tease this just a little bit, and we'll say that at the end, we're going to talk about a Ute that was supposed to be here in the United States as of 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
Never showed up. Never showed up. And it would have been, and I feel strongly about this. I think this would have been a wildly popular vehicle.
I do want to hear about that. Okay, we've teased it for the end.
All right, so
here we are in Australia.
We're still talking about Holden, and I want to tell you that, you know, these are pretty strong performance vehicles, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, oddly enough, I mean, I'm looking at the numbers, and they're given in kilowatts, which is a little odd for us here in the United States, you know, the ratings, the power ratings, and I've converted them. So, you know, the Holden Ute, the standard Ute, produces 210 kilowatts of power from a 3.6 liter V6. That's 281 horsepower.
That is great.
That's pretty strong.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty strong engine for, you know, the type or size of vehicle that we're talking about. And then there's the SV6, and that's again 210, so again 281 horsepower. And then there's the whole SS range, and there's three versions of the SS range. There's the SS, the SSV, and then the SSV Redline. And these produce 362 horsepower, Ben. That's pretty strong. I mean, that's close to four. I mean, well,
362
horsepower from all from the same engine. They all have this a 6-liter Gen 4 V8 engine. That's I think it's an alloy engine, very strong engine. But I'll tell you, Ben, that's not the creme de la creme.
No,
it is not. There's another version of the Holden vehicles that we will get to. But I also want to talk about that Ford is still building Ute vehicles in Australia. So you can go right now, you can go to a Ford Australia website and look up the, you know, let's say you look up the 2013 Ford Falcon Ute, because they're still building the Falcon in Australia.
Pretty popular model.
A lot of us here in the United States will say, well, they haven't built the Falcon for a long, long time, right? But they still do there.
Yeah.
I think they have a sedan version. They have, I don't know if they have a coupe version or not. They also have this, this Ute version, and they have actually five different body styles of the Ute in the Ford Falcon version. So.
And are those, a lot of those are differences in tray size, right?
Well, yeah, I think some of that is and different shape, I suppose, because there's a cab chassis, which looks a lot more like what we'd think of as a small pickup truck. And then there's, of course, an XR6 version of the same thing. Then there's a single side box version, which I will have to look up the difference between these. There's small differences.
It's way easier if you visit the website and check them out.
Exactly.
Yourself,
and then again, an XR6 version of the same thing, this what is it, a style side box, I think is what I said. Mm-hmm. And then there's the XR6 Turbo, which has an inline six engine with, again, 198 kilowatts of power, which is 269 horsepower. So that's, again, another strong ute, and that's coming from Ford.
Yes.
And, okay, I'm going to mention these right now, and then we'll go to the Holden version, because the Holden version is just a notch above them, I think, in performance.
All right.
All right. So there's, you know, we mentioned the Ford Falcon.
Yep.
There's also a company called Ford Performance Vehicles in Australia, and it was founded in 2002, and they're called FPV, I guess, for short.
Mm-hmm.
And headquarters are in Melbourne, Australia, Victoria, Australia. And FPV F6 Tornado Ute from about 2005 or 2008 to present produces 310 kilowatts of power, Ben, from a 4-liter turbo engine. That's 420 horsepower in a ute vehicle.
And wow.
And when you look at it, yeah, it looks like a sport vehicle. I mean, it looks like a sports car. If you didn't see the back end, if you just saw it straight from the front,
yeah,
it looks like a sports car.
I bet its acceleration has got to be pretty nasty, too.
I don't have any idea what the 0-60 is or any of that.
So.
I mean, we'll have to look it up on the website. But, uh-huh. I mean, just to give you an idea of the type of power that some of these brand-new utes are producing. I mean, again, 420 horsepower from this Ford.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go up just a little bit more for the Holdens.
This is the creme?
This is the one.
All right.
All right. So Holden has a vehicle or a line of vehicles, I guess. And I don't even know if you can say it's Holden's because it's a subsidiary of Holden Vehicles, I think, or a I guess another company that they ship the vehicles to, a specialty manufacturer, and they do performance upgrades on their cars. And I don't think this is all that unusual to any of our listeners because, you know, BMW has its M cars,
sure,
you know, Mercedes has its AMG division, and Holden has its division called HSV or Holden Specialty Vehicles. And they produce a car, and it's got a funny name, but it's fun to say, the Maloo. And
right,
yeah, the HSV Maloo, they make something called the standard Maloo, and then they make a Maloo R8 version. And even the standard Maloo, Ben, the standard Maloo, which has a 6.2-liter LS3 Gen 4 V8, produces 317 kilowatts of power, which is 425 horsepower. And when you look at it, you know, look at a photo of the HSV Maloo online, and I think you'll be blown away because it has a lot of characteristics of like, and I know this is a silly comparison, but
sure,
like a Corvette or something like that. It has side vents. It has, you know, just a low, squatted down appearance, wide wheels.
Okay.
It's a very long vehicle. In a way, it kind of grabs you as that type of vehicle, even though it has a truck bed on the back.
So it's a low slung performance vehicle with a truck bed.
With a truck bed that you can haul your pigs to market on Monday, right?
Yeah, and race on Wednesday.
Yeah, race on Saturday, go to church on Sunday, and yeah, exactly. So, and then they make a version called the Maloo R8, which is just a little bit more performance squeezed out of the same engine, 325 kilowatts of power or 436 horsepower.
That's got to be the top.
That is the top, and people are using these to you know, break production speed records, I guess.
Yeah.
A guy took in June of 2006 a regular production Z Series Maloo R8 broke the world's record for the fastest production utility pickup truck, and that's what they call it for this thing, a utility pickup truck. He went, and it doesn't sound all that fast, but you got to remember it's a pickup truck. It went 271 kilometers per hour or 168 miles per hour, and you think, well, 168, that's fast, but it's not real fast.
Right.
Consider this. It took the record away from a Dodge Ram SRT10, which is the Dodge Ram pickup with the Viper V10 engine.
Yeah.
And the top speed that had was 13.7 miles per hour slower than the Maloo R8.
Whoa.
So you get an idea of how fast this thing is. And we know the Dodge Ram SRT10 here in the United States as a production, you know, speedy, I don't know how to put this, a fast production truck.
Sure.
Extremely fast, as you can imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this tops that. So you can imagine just how quickly they're moving along. And it's a smaller vehicle. I guess maybe that's got something
some,
that's like, going
weight,
for it.
Weight to power.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, it doesn't have the big V10 of the SRT10, but it does have a very strong V8, as you would find in a Corvette again.
And let us not be remiss. You guys, we know that we've been talking primarily about U.S. and Australian manufacturers of utes, but there are worldwide manufacturers because the market has grown so much that other car companies saw this in Europe and Asia and said, we have got to get in the game. What are we doing? We're just losing money. So Subaru has a the Japanese manufacturer Subaru has the Brumby. This is a small all-wheel drive model. It comes from the second generation Leone. This was sold between 1978 and 93. It shows up in popular culture. It was built in Japan, but they never sold it in Japan. And then there's one that the name of this one makes me laugh, Scott. The Suzuki Mighty Boy.
Suzuki Mighty Boy.
Yeah.
That's an odd name.
Yeah, it's a version of the Alto, and they sold it in Japan, Australia, and here's a wild card for you, Cyprus.
No kidding.
Apparently, Cyprus also wanted a Mighty Boy. Mm. So Toyota also sold some Ute variants of the Corona, and then they also had the Toyota Hilux, which in 2011 was Australia's highest-selling Ute.
Now, I've heard of that one before. I think they had a Crown also. There was one called a Crown.
Yeah, yeah.
And, man, there's a lot of different manufacturers. I mean, they're from Australia, United States. There's sure. Latin America market. There's yes. There's South Africa.
Yep.
You mentioned Japan or for the Japanese market.
Yeah, BMW.
There's even Soviet Russia cars. The Lada manufacturers created a utility vehicle that they called a coupe utility.
Uh-huh.
But it's really, you know, it's a Lada with a small bed on the back.
Sure.
As we mentioned, those are pretty decent off-road vehicles. I mean, they can be. Uh-huh. So they're all, and when I think of Subaru, Ben, you know, you were surprised me with the Subaru that you mentioned. I don't remember which one it was now.
The Brumby.
I always think, when I think Subaru, I think of two things. I think of the Baja, which is the more recent version.
Sure.
And then I think of the Subaru Brat.
I knew you were going to say Brat. Yeah.
The Brat with those two seats that would face rearward, and you had kind of the ski handles with the pistol grips on them,
uh-huh.
or the almost like ski grips, I guess.
Yeah.
I just picture that vehicle every time I think of this type of thing, the coupe utility, or Subaru in general.
And
really.
Actually, the I think that it's the same vehicle. It's called the Brat in other countries.
Oh, no kidding.
It's the Brumby in Australia.
Oh, okay.
Now, somebody check me. Perhaps I am wrong on this one. I'm not sure exactly what it's called, but it's been called the Brat, the Shifter, the MV, or the Targa.
And there's Plymouth made them. They made the Rampage and the Scout.
Yeah.
They made some from, there was Hyundai who made a car called the Pony. Morris, who made the Marina pickup. Volkswagen has made a bunch of these. I know that they've got a few out there. There's a manufacturer called Singer, who made them in the 1950s. There's a lot of different versions of this, and we're only covering really just a couple. But,
yeah.
You know, the Australian market is just flooded with Ford and Holden vehicles. And, you know, speaking of Holden vehicles and, you know what, I'll tell you what, I don't want to get to the very last thing yet.
Okay.
I want to talk about a couple of prototypes that beforehand, and then we'll get to the last thing. How about that?
Okay. Well, before we jump into that, can I say something about the cultural impact with this?
Of course.
I think it's important to note. In his letter, Wayne notes some things about Utes, in Australia. And this is stuff that I think will be interesting. Now, Australian listeners, you probably already know about this. So this is more of a clarion call to anybody around the world listening to the show who's planning to head to Australia and likes Utes. There's an annual event in the town of Deniliquin, which I am probably grossly mispronouncing.
Two for one there.
So thousands of people come together with their Utes. And Wayne says, I can only describe this as a Burning Man with the distinct aim of burning rubber instead. So these are called Ute musters. That's, whenever people in Australia meet up to have their, to show their Utes, to drive them around together.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you can see these all across Australia, especially in rural areas, Australia, New Zealand, particularly. And one of the things that I thought you and I would both really like, and I think our listeners like this too, is the heavily customized Utes.
Oh, very cool.
So we're talking, got some spotlights on there, some mud flaps, some aerials. This sounds pretty neat.
It's a summer setup for full off-road and remote use.
Yes.
Used in very, very remote areas in Australia, right?
Yeah.
Those do sound interesting.
So I wanted to, just note again what a tremendously big impact that these vehicles have had, and why they've inspired car companies from across the world to make cars or to make utes just for this market.
Well, that muster sounds like an interesting thing to attend. That sounds like a lot of fun.
You
said it's like a Burning Man with utility vehicles.
Yeah, just for burning rubber.
Interesting. Yeah, and you want one quick thing here.
Yeah.
Isn't a muster what they call it when you, on a cruise ship, when you have to put on your life jacket and go onto the main deck to the area that you would board your, I think that's what they call it, right? I believe that is.
You go on a lot of cruises.
I've been in a couple, but I thought that's what they call it, a muster. When you go, you put on your jacket, you know, your life jacket, and you go down and you wait in the area where you would board your life raft if it came to that. Hopefully it never does.
Yeah.
But I think that's what they call it, a muster. Anyways. Let's move on.
Yeah,
we're
on.
Way off track here.
Sorry,
now. Let's get back to prototypes. I want to mention two prototypes, and then I want to talk about that that last one that we talked about, the youth that never was.
Uh-huh.
So the prototypes, I want to talk about this one that we've heard of this one before, a guy named Joshua Baker. And Joshua Baker, is that one of the...
Joshua Baker wrote to us...
about this episode.
Yeah.
So Joshua Baker has contacted us in the past from Virginia and said that he wanted to hear a little bit about the AMC Cowboy. Remember that vehicle?
Yes.
And that was this odd vehicle that he had come across during research or something, and he mentioned it to us in that it was an AMC Gremlin kind of mixed with a Jeep pickup. Hmm. And it was just this odd, strange thing that AMC... never really put forth. They decided that, you know, once AMC acquired Jeep, or they decided that they just weren't going to build this because they already had something that was similar. It wasn't going to work out. But look up the AMC Cowboy and take a look at that photo and see if it was something that you would purchase.
Let us know.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was another one that was called the BMW M3 Ute pickup, and this is a more recent version. This one is from, and this is strange, Ben, April Fool's Day in 2011. So it kind of makes you wonder right there, you know, when they release this information on April Fool's Day, is it really something they're going to do? And BMW announced on that day that they were going to create a BMW M3 Ute pickup. And what it turned out being, Ben, is that they created this thing as kind of a shop vehicle.
Yeah, it's on the basis of an E93 convertible.
Exactly.
Right?
And we've heard this before. There was a Rolls-Royce truck.
Yeah.
That they created as a shop truck, remember? And this is true. I mean, it really happened. And there really is a BMW M3 Ute pickup.
Right.
It's just used as a shop vehicle for BMW.
Yeah, you can't buy it.
And same with the Rolls-Royce. It was just a shop vehicle for the factories to, transport materials back and forth within the factory.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was ever sold or if anybody ever picked it up. I don't remember what the story was behind that.
We'll have to look into that. But interestingly enough about this, the April Fool's BMW vehicle, it was called a pickup. In the UK and the US, in Australia, it was called a
ute. Of course it was. Now, what else are they going to call it? I mean, it does look like a ute. I'll tell you that.
It totally looks like a ute.
Okay. And I know I promised we're going to do one more thing, but I got one thing I want to slide in before that. How about
all
that?
Right.
And a quick mention and then we're done.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the shape and general size of these ute vehicles and what it called to mind. And if you're not familiar with these, take a look at them online. Just do Google search and look at the photos. The old Cadillac flower cars. From the like professional cars and like when we're talking about ambulances and hearses.
Yeah.
Cadillac made a car called a flower car that was either going to carry the casket or it would just carry flowers to and from the funeral home and the graveyard. And there were processional vehicles, and they were very ornate and large vehicles, but they have the exact same size and look of the ute vehicles we're talking about, a little bit longer maybe because they were great big vehicles, big Cadillacs.
Yeah.
But very interesting, I guess, correlation between the two. To me, they look like they could be called a ute vehicle, even though I know that they're a professional vehicle and with a very specific purpose.
The only reason I know what the flower car is because of our episode on hearses.
Mm-hmm. And if the listeners haven't, listened to that podcast, they should do that. But
yeah, I thought that was a good one.
That was a fun one to do. Yeah. And also quickly look up the flower car, the Cadillac flower cars, and you'll see exactly what I mean. They have a very strong resemblance to the utes that we're talking about.
And now we come to the final moment.
Yeah, the last thing that we wanted to talk about, and this is a strange thing, Ben, because it was scheduled to happen. Now, you remember we talked about Holden and their connection with General Motors, their subsidiary.
Yep.
Well, this makes sense when you think about it, but Pontiac, when they started making that car called the G8.
Yeah, the Pontiac G8ST.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Well, this ST stands for sport truck, right?
Yep.
And the sports truck was a vehicle that we never got, but it was a concept vehicle that was shown at the New York International Auto Show in 2008. And it was a concept that I think people were favorable to this thing. They said they were actually going to produce it in 2010 and it was going to come to the United States. And I was pretty excited about this because we haven't had really a strong utility vehicle like that, ute vehicle like everybody else has really,
right,
as we're finding out.
Every other place.
We haven't had a big, strong, powerful one like that in a long time, since the El Camino.
Right, and this was unveiled as the VE Commodore Ute, right?
Yeah, exactly, because again, Commodore is another vehicle that Holden produces. They produce another vehicle that the Monaro, I think, is what we created, or we called the GTO here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's this mix of, you know, back and forth, and they rebadge them for whatever market they're in. So they bring them over here and they call them GTO. Over there, they're called the Monaro. Over there, the Commodore. Over here, it would be one of these vehicles. It would have been a Commodore sports truck, really.
And the audience liked it in 08 and they said, we're going to make this in 2010.
Yeah,
it's on the way.
And people were excited because it was on the G8 platform. So this is something they could definitely do.
Right.
And it had a 361 horsepower, 6-liter V8 engine, which was the same as the G8 GT car that they had. And, you know, we see those on the road. They're great looking cars and they're very, very powerful, quick cars. Slated for 2010 release, but due to the budget cuts and then eventually the entire cutting of the Pontiac line in 2009.
Right.
We never got it.
It is, we do know that at least one confirmed prototype was built.
Yeah. I wonder where that thing is. I wonder if it ended up in the GM Heritage collection.
Yeah, maybe.
It may be there. I don't know where they keep their prototype vehicles, because I don't know if that's just production vehicles or not. You know what? They do have prototype vehicles in the Heritage collection, because they have all the Firebird vehicles.
Yeah, they do have prototypes, but it's not as if they have every single prototype they've ever done.
That's true. This one may be in a warehouse somewhere. It may be on display at a GM headquarters somewhere. I just don't know where this thing is.
Maybe hidden in the home of an eccentric billionaire.
Could be. It'd be interesting to find out. And it's really no mystery. I mean, I'm not saying that's lost or anything
like that.
Yeah,
I just haven't looked into it.
Yeah, we just haven't found out where it is. But it's too bad that we didn't get the G8 ST here in the United States, because I think that's something that our market needs and wants. And, you know, Australia, they've got so many of these things out there. I mean, they've got the HSV Maloo. The Maloo R8, and then Ford has got the version of, what do they call that? It had an acronym for it. The FPV F6 or whatever it was called.
Uh-huh.
The Tornado version, the Typhoon version. You know, they've got all these different versions. But I think it's something that's lacking from the U.S. market, and I wish we had it.
And, never say never. Perhaps it will return to our shores. Scott, I think we're about wrapped up here, yeah?
I think so. And I know Australian listeners are saying, you didn't mention
this
X or Y or whatever
Z,
it was. Yeah. So I hope we've covered it definitely to the best that we could do.
Yeah. And we'd like to thank John, Josh, and Wayne, as well as everybody else who wrote in to ask for more stuff about the Utes. Now, Scott, I'm into this idea of the Ute culture. I'd like to learn more about these musters.
You know, I would too. I would too. That's an interesting thing. I mean, that's a cool gathering of people. I would like to see what goes on. Maybe we can find some videos, some literature about it. You know, what happens when it's happening, maybe?
Yeah, maybe we can talk to our bosses about a road trip.
Put it on the expense report and head out there, right? A couple of first-class tickets to Australia. That's what we need.
Yeah, first-class tickets to Australia with Ute rentals.
Yeah, that's right, with a Maloo R8 rental.
All right. Well, I'm going to go for that. I'm going to go for that Commodore.
That's a tall order, Ben.
Well, we'll see. You know what? We'll start working on it now. And Scott, as you and I are heading out to research our next adventure, do you have anything in particular? Some email you'd like to get?
You know what, Ben? How about we skip it this time? We've been talking for almost an hour about Ute vehicles, and I feel like we're still kind of just scratching the surface on these things. Let's just move on, and we'll get the email next time, maybe.
Yeah, and if you would like your email to be read on the show, then go ahead and write to us. Our email address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.